When it comes to maximizing time in the uplands, without fail, Onyx Hunt is my most valuable tool. From planning my next hunt through a new bird cover to navigating in the field, Onyx Hunt is truly with me wherever I go. With detailed mapping and satellite imagery, along with a multitude of map layers from land access to forestry and habitat information, and easy-to-use tools to mark, measure, and catalog important information, Onyx Hunt seamlessly integrates digital scouting with boots-on-the-ground time in the field. With offline mapping and Apple CarPlay integration, you are free to explore the wild landscapes our beloved upland birds inhabit. Planning your next move in the uplands begins with knowing where you stand, and for me, that starts and stops with Onyx Hunt. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. When the miles rack up faster than your flush count, that's when you'll truly appreciate your hunting vest from Final Rise. Built for the uplands and proudly sewn in the USA, the complete lineup of hunting vests from Final Rise, from their all-new Summit XT down to the minimalist Sidekick system, are all built upon the foundational load-bearing waist belt and low-profile shoulder strap system, which allow you to carry all the gear you need and do so comfortably while maintaining your ability to move freely and perform when you need to most. With a complete lineup of accessories and newly released performance field apparel, Final Rise has the gear you need to help you get the most out of every mile and every flush. Final Rise gear is built for the uplands. Get yours today at finalrise.com. This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we mix in plenty of quail hunting and shotgun conversation with Randy Schultz. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 206. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. We've got a great conversation coming up with Randy Schultz in just a moment. But first, I'd like to thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show. And for that, I thank you. All Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast are eligible for monthly giveaways, bonus content, exclusive discounts, and we set everybody up with a little welcome pack, including some Birdshot Podcast canned coolers and stickers. You can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot, where you can also, still for a limited time, see the grouse hunting video I contributed on from Nick Adair at the Gundog It Yourself podcast. That is still only viewable for patrons of the Birdshot podcast and the GDIY podcast until next month sometime. Then everybody out there will have a chance to see it. So just a heads up for Patreon patrons of the show. See it early there. And again, thank you to Patreon patrons of the show. All right, don't forget, leave a rating, leave a review. Subscribe to and follow the show. Also, things you can do, just take a moment and support the Birdshot Podcast. So thanks for that as well. All right, what else do I got for reminders? Use the promo code BSP20. Save 20% on your Onyx Hunt subscription. And Pheasant Fest upcoming next month. As I mentioned on the last couple episodes, I will be there helping out mainly in the Upland Gun Company booth. We're going to have a nice display there. I just got some more photos from Italy this morning. I know from talking to a lot of you, there are some people excited to finally get a chance to see the guns from RFM, Upland Gun Company, at the show next month. So we're looking forward to that, and we're looking forward to connecting with everybody there. Be sure to stop by the Upland Gun Company booth and say hi if you are going to be at Pheasant Fest in Minneapolis next month. All right, quick intro. Let's jump into it. Let's get into today's conversation with Randy Schultz. You may know Randy from one of the multiple avenues of content he puts out, including his two books, Endless October and Endless October Season 2. He's got a YouTube channel, a podcast, a website, all under the umbrella of A Bird Hunter's Thoughts. I will include links to all of those in the show notes for you to check out. And Randy and I caught up earlier this week, discussed a number of topics, including quail hunting, Randy's bird dogs, Nastra events, shotguns, and more. I had a blast talking to Randy. I think you'll enjoy this one. Happy Friday, everybody. Have a great weekend. And let's welcome into the conversation and onto the Birdshot Podcast, Randy Schultz. make sure I got a full cup of coffee here. Are you a coffee drinker, Andy?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't met too many bird hunters that are not coffee drinkers.
Yeah, I don't know why that is, but it's true.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Well, welcome to the Birdshot Podcast. You won't know this, but I want to say you're kind of a long overdue guest. You've been suggested to me a number of times, and you've kind of been in the back of my mind. I've seen some of your YouTube videos, and I have yet to read either of your books, but so shame on me, but we'll ask you about those today. But I know that, I believe it was Sarah Deline Gomes, I think she was the first one to ever bring you to my attention, and so we'll credit her for suggesting you to be on the show. But thanks for joining us today, Randy.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I know Sarah really well. I'll have to tell her thank you as well.
Yeah, she said this was years ago, but I never forgot. She had very kind words. She said you were an interesting guy. You were an airline pilot, is that correct?
Yeah, I was. Okay. And flew for a major airline. I flew for the Navy first, and then got out of the Navy and then flew for Delta. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. All right. Yeah, that's I remember all that from a quick little message exchange with Sarah. So thanks to Sarah for that. But you're back home. I know you were just out on a hunting trip. What's the status of Randy's hunting season? Is it over? On hiatus? What's going on, Randy?
Yeah, sad to say. Over, but only because there's nothing open. I just got back from New Mexico and Arizona hunting quail.
Okay.
And merns, gambles, and blue quail. And it was a great trip. Arizona, in fact, Arizona's open for another week or two.
Okay.
I think I'm not sure, but sometimes in February, but they've got a great year this year. And so we had fun. And, but I started out in September. I went in October, November. I took December off to get some work done on my back, and went again in January. So that was I usually go on 5 trips a year.
Yeah. What's going on with the back, if you don't mind me asking?
72 years of hard living, I think. probably sum it up in a nutshell there. I don't know. I was having trouble, it was just sore and achy. And then I started having some nerve problems in my legs. And I said, nah, it's getting serious. Went to see a doc. We did the MRI thing. It was just, and he said, when did you crush your disc? And I said, the bone, the vertebra.
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't know I did. And he said, well, you've done it more than once. And I said, well, it must have been a good time, but I don't remember what happened. I didn't eject out of an airplane. I didn't,
Jeez.
I was talking to my buddy who's a retired military pilot that I go stay with out in Tucson. And he said that, Randy, you're pulling 6 Gs. You're looking over your shoulder. You're reaching with your arms and doing this, for a half hour at a time. And on and off and on and off. It's a wonder more of us aren't in wheelchairs. So that's probably why.
How are the ergonomics in those old Navy jets?
Well, they weren't real good because you had to always plan on ejecting. So you couldn't have a lot of cushion because when that ejection seat takes off, if you're a quarter of an inch out of your seat, that ejection seat will break both your legs.
So, kind of like if you were pulling up on a bird and you held the shotgun a quarter inch off your shoulder, that wouldn't be good, right?
Yeah, we all know what that feels like.
Unfortunately,
Or you don't get it right up to your shoulder and you end up whacking yourself in the chest.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully that improves for you. The reason I ask is I'm 37, so quite a bit younger than you, Randy, but I'm starting to feel some of those aches and pains myself, and I've been paying attention to my back a little bit more lately. Just, I would consider it minor, but one of those things that there seems to be quite a bit of mystery, with the back and spine and how that whole chain can kind of play tricks on you and the rest of your body, really.
Yeah. And it can go, you'll think it's something else and it's all in your back. The nerves run through everything below the waist to go through your back. I mean, it's just amazing what, up through the top and a couple epidurals and I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. It's a continuing story, but one thing I do know is you got to have everything work to be a successful bird hunter. You got to be able to walk. You got to be able to have, You can do it without everything working, but it's one sport where you really, really do need everything working.
Yeah, so. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, well, you're 72 and still giving it, so that's life goals for the rest of us listening, Randy.
Yeah, well, it can be done for sure.
Where did this business start for you? Did bird hunting come later in life, or does it go way back to when you were younger? How did you get started into bird hunting?
Well, you know, I'd always wanted to say that I learned to bird hunt from my dad and been doing it all my life, but that's not the case. I was actually 40 years old and went out to my deer lease with a friend of mine. It's actually a story in my first book.
Okay.
And I went out to a deer lease. I was walking out of the deer lease before light, and I stepped into a covey of quail. The lease had just been clear cut the year before, so... you know, they cut all the trees down, everything down around, clear cut. That's what they do down here. So, boy, I yelled, I yelled like a schoolgirl, and my buddy started laughing at me, and he was laughing, and, you know, we're sitting there with our flashlights trying to be quiet. And so, we laugh a little bit. We took another couple of steps, and he stepped into another covey of quail and did the same thing. So that got me to thinking, you know, the real smart guy that I am. And I'd always wondered about bird hunting. And so that really planted the seed. And then my wife bought me a Brittany out of the Atlanta paper hunting section. I know that's going to make a lot of readers cringe.
I love it.
But that's how I got my first dog. And his name was Rocket. And that was the end of the startup story, because I never looked back. Never hunted deer again. Never hunted anything again.
No kidding.
That I had a 2,000 acre deer lease. I was the only bird hunter on it, and I had a private southern quail hunting plantation all to myself for 5 years, and until it just grew up too much, I couldn't get in there.
That was convenient, though.
It was wonderful. Yeah, it was great. And I couldn't get enough of it. I would either fly for I was actually flying for my airline at the time. I was also flying in the Navy Reserves at the time. And if I wasn't doing that, I was bird hunting. And it was just, you know, you could take any dog and make them a bird dog if you hunt that much.
Right.
And it's really what I did, because my first dog was not a genetic marvel. In fact, he wasn't a very good bird dog, but I killed thousands of birds over him. And we hunted a lot. And so he got to be pretty good.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I didn't even start traveling to hunt until, I guess, about 6 or 7 years later.
Okay.
I got grown up out of the lease, and my buddy said, why don't we go someplace to hunt where they got birds? And so we looked around and decided to go to Kansas, and that's how it started. So.
How was now being 30 years later, so you got some more perspective and you traveled around. How was the hunting on that first lease? Was it pretty good quail hunting at that time for that window?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We had, I had the coveys named, you know, cemetery covey and the plantation covey and such, you know, like guys do.
Sure.
And I would, you know, the first couple of years they were huge, and I would be able to hunt and go down, and if I didn't get into 10 coveys, you know, something was wrong.
Yeah.
And 10 coveys of Bob Whites in the South. I mean, you know, they're great days when you can go down and on those plantations and hunt near wild birds, and you can get 15, 20 coveys up and so on like that. But where I was, a guy didn't know what he was doing. I was using a sawed off 12 gauge, for crying out loud. I didn't know what I was doing. I had nothing. And, Not illegal sawed off, you know.
But, yeah, I hear you. Yeah. How short were the barrels?
Yeah, it was, well, I don't know, it was about 22 inches.
Yeah, that's legal.
But, I mean, it would eject a shell, but not by much.
Was it a pump gun or something?
No, it was a, what was it? It was a Remington 12 gauge semi-auto.
Okay.
That's okay. All I remember about it. I ended up giving it to a guy on his plantation because he was starting up a plantation. I said, you need a loaner gun. This is a piece of junk, but you can have it. And it's like he looked at it and he goes, oh my gosh, your pattern's about 6 feet wide. You know?
Like, yeah. Isn't it funny though? You know, you think back to when you're just getting started, when you don't overanalyze everything, and I mean, depending on what kind of person you are, but you know, you get a Brittany out of the newspaper from your wife and a sawed off Remington semi-auto, and you're having a blast just quail hunting.
Oh my gosh, yeah! And I just lived it. I wasn't too much, you know. That was back, and most hunters do this, I think, when they start out, they get into killing.
Yeah.
And they get out there and they want a limit. They want a limit. Not as a bad
chasing,
thing.
Chasing the success. Yeah.
Yeah. Limit equals success. And that's the way I was. And, you know, I'm not saying that with pride. In fact, I'm saying a little embarrassed about it. But yeah, that's thankfully most people grow out of that. Most people do. I've seen guys my age are the same way. But anyway, that, you know, that's what it was all about to me. It was finding the birds and just the thrill. Mm-hmm. Finding the birds. I wasn't too much into the dog work, which was probably good, because I didn't have much of a dog. But I was amazed that I could look at a field out there in my lease and know generally kind of where the birds were, but look at my dog and think he's going to go find those birds and I'm going to shoot one. And, you know, for some reason, that always just totally amazed me that we could find something that is totally, completely hidden.
Yeah.
By using a dog's nose.
Yeah.
That is, and that still fascinates me today.
The light bulb, you know, moment.
Going out to Arizona where I just was and looking at a piece of a tract of land that's nothing but rolling grass, rocky, nasty, thorny hills, and thinking, you know, there's probably 10 coveys of blue quail out there right now. I can't see them, but this little thing next to me is going to go find them.
Yep.
And, you know, and just turning them loose. I just love that. I love that.
Yeah. Very cool. A couple things coming to mind. I just watched yesterday your most recent quail hunt. Is that from this just recently then?
Oh yeah. Last week.
Okay. There was a scene in there where I wanted to talk to you about Brittany's. I knew we would get into that, obviously, but I have two English setters. The listeners will know that, and they're the only two dogs I've ever had. But I wonder if someday there might be a Brittany in my future. Just of all the other breeds, there's something about them that I'm drawn to, and I love the way, and you see it in other dogs, it's not exclusive to Brittany's, but when they are moving and relocating on scent, and I saw one of your dogs do it in the video, and they're kind of doing that stealth, you know, creep, track, follow, whatever you want to call it, but it's very deliberate and it's intentional. I mean, when any bird dog does that, that's the kind of stuff that just, that fires me up.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exciting. You know, let me rephrase that. I do field trials as well. I do National Shooter field trials. And, you know, we call that when a dog strikes bird scent, and then creeps in real slow like that. Mm-hmm. That's not a good thing. And so what we want to see in the field trial world is a dog slam that point,
right,
and be rock solid steady, you know. So, but slamming scent and being rock solid steady when you're hunting blue quail is a loser, because those quail move.
Yep.
And your dog will be on point and those birds will be 100 yards away and walking away. And you're still kicking around in front of that dog trying to find those birds.
Yep.
You want a dog that's smart enough to say, the birds are gone. And he's basically trailing their scent.
Yep.
Until they stop. And then he stops again. And all of my dogs are good at, well, except for the puppy, all of my dogs are good at that. And that really, when you see a dog doing that, you know, you really got a really, really good bird dog. I can take that very same dog though out into a field trial. On into a NASTRA field trial, and he will slam a bird and be rock solid, you know, won't move an inch.
Right. Yep. Yeah, that's a great point that you bring up there. And would you say that that's primarily due to the birds at the field trial? They're pretty much stationary, not moving. So if the dog has the bird, a good dog that knows what he's doing, like I said, being intentional about it, if the bird's not moving, the dog's not moving.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And like I say, the negative side to that is if the bird's not moving and the dog is moving,
bad.
You know, that's not good. Yep. That's not good.
Yep.
Eventually, they're going to get close enough to the bird's going to say, "I'm out of here." It's
yes.
going to flush.
Yep.
And we call that bumping the bird, and that's yep. that. You know, that's not the thing. Yep. Yep. And, you know, dog can bump birds in the wild, too. You know, and we don't know where the birds are or when the dog gets into the scent cone. So, you know, he may get in the scent cone too close for for the birds, to the covey.
Correct.
And, you know, once he hits that scent cone, you know, I can tell pretty much any bird dog, really, watching them, when they hit that scent cone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell when the dog hits a scent cone, if he doesn't really slow down and kind of start looking like he's going to point, you know, uh-oh, this is not good.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, next thing you're going to see is a bird come up, probably. So, but that's all part of working with bird dogs. And, you know, after watching them for so long, you know, I can kind of look and watch a bird dog for a while and
yep.
say, I like that dog, you know. So a dog just thinks.
Yes. So. Yeah, yeah. Going back to Brittany number one, because I think there may be some, now you had, based on your comments, you know, you weren't thinking much about dog training. You were thinking about hunting and chasing quail, and you just brought the dog with, and I'm assuming you were pretty much shooting at anything that flew. What do you remember about that dog's development and how it maybe overcame some of your mistakes or oversights, whatever you want to call them, and how did that dog's development play out with the two of you learning how to hunt together, basically?
Yeah, that was Rocket was his name. Randy's Red Hot Rocket. That was his name. And, you know, he was given to me on my 40th birthday by my wife. And, you know, she didn't know where to get a bird or a dog. So, you know, I hunted that dog the absolute limit of his genetic ability. And it took a while because he was probably trying to hunt me to my limits of my genetic ability. But Rocket was, he was really a blue collar dog. And he, you know, I sent him to a trainer because I didn't know that that's not really all that necessary, but I figured dog trainers are out there. And
yep.
I found a dog trainer in the back of a magazine. It was a back of like an outdoor magazine, one of those little 1-inch ads back there, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a dog trainer in Tennessee. So I took Rocket up there, and the man was too nice and too smart to directly insult me. So he worked with Rocket, but you know, I kind of got the idea that, you know, Rocket wasn't the best bred bird dog out there, and he really wasn't, you know, he really didn't have what it took to be just a really champion classic bird dog. But that dog hunted from daylight to dark through every type of terrain that you can imagine and loved to find birds. So I was, and in retrospect, I tried to tally up how many birds I'd actually killed over him, you know, counting field trials as well.
Yeah.
And it was thousands of birds. And, you know, he wouldn't back because I never hunted with anybody else. There was no reason for him to back.
Gotcha.
And so in field trials, you know, about half the time I got picked up because he would interfere with the other dog.
And
so I had to go get my dog and do the walk of shame off the field, you know. So, but he got better and better and better, and I got to trust him. And that was back before GPS. So all I was listening to was a bell or sometimes a beeper.
Yep.
You know, beepers came along. They were just an amazing innovation.
Right.
You know? So it was that long ago now. We forget that with our GPS stuff. But
yeah.
So he grew and grew and grew. And then I realized I needed another dog. I was going to run my dog to death.
Yep.
So I needed another dog. And, you know, don't get me wrong. Rocket lived inside the house with me. He was my buddy. You know, he wasn't just a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't live out in the kennel or anything like that. So I ended up buying a setter, and she was amazing. And she went out. Rocket never really got too far from me, but Ruby was her name. And she would get out, you know, 100 yards, and she was an all-white dream, and she was wonderful, a wonderful bird dog. Hybrid, trained herself, literally trained herself.
Yeah.
Point, back, retrieve, and, you know, those genetics, when they come out, a friend of mine reminded me the other day of a trainer that talked to him. This is an old saying, so I don't know who to attribute it to, but the trainer told him one time, said, Randy, or his name was Gary, said, Gary, you can either buy training or you can buy genetics. And you're going to find out what you want pretty soon. And I realized the genetics are what you want.
Yeah.
So this girl had it, and she was amazing. So, and then I hunted for two dogs. So I had two dogs, Rocket and Ruby.
Love
for
it.
Many, many years until I ended up buying other dogs. But that's pretty much the way it started.
Yeah. I think I've hunted over at least one or maybe two setters named Ruby. So that brings up some fond memory. What, you didn't stick with the setters. Was there, what the Brittany stole your heart, or what's the story there?
Well, Rocket was a, not only was a, was he a Brittany, but he was a liver Brittany, you know, brown one.
Okay.
So I had Ruby, and then I had several setters. I had Jet, I okay. had Bo, Grits, all kinds of other setters, and Jet. I had Jet, Randy Smoking Jet. But finally, I just decided I had to decide what I was going to do, go one way or the other, just to keep from having too many different kinds of airplanes to fly here.
You wanted to stick with something. Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, I just wanted to stick with something. So I went back and got another liver. That's squeaking. It's my puppy. I hope she's not bothering me.
No, it's all right. I'm surprised my Rose isn't doing the same thing.
So I ended up getting another liver Brittany, a male, and went from there. His name was Ace. And just a minute. That's going to not be good. Anyway, Ace. And he fathered pretty much everything else that I have now. He's passed away now. And the female that I use, Ruby, she passed away right after Thanksgiving. So, you know, but all those, everything I've got, pretty much the bloodlines come from them, except this little puppy. This little puppy came out from another breeder down here in Georgia.
Okay. But, how old is that pup?
She is, let's see, a little over 7 months, between 7 and 8 months.
Okay. So she got some runs in this fall, I'm assuming.
Yeah, she did. I took her to Arizona and New Mexico, and I've got her in a couple of my videos. Well, she's in that video.
Okay.
She's in that. Every once in a while, you'll see Shaq on point or Cap on point, and here comes a little brown fur missile heading through the field of view. Arizona slows down, and I did notice that later in the video, she did flush. She flushed some blue quail. And she flushed some Mearns quail.
Okay.
But I just noticed it in the video. I didn't, you know, bird flushed. I didn't know where it came from. And I turned around and shot, and I didn't even see her. So she flushed the bird. she didn't point the whole time. She's got, it's amazing because she's doing it all in the field except finding birds. So I know she's smelling them. She just doesn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So since we've been back, I've been putting out a bird a day and putting her on a bird and letting her point, you know, letting her just stroke her and telling her bird, and then going and kicking her up, kicking the bird up and let her chase it. Let her get all excited. And so we're just starting that now. So, yeah, next year she'll be ready. Next year she'll be ready. So.
Love it. So just on that note, because I think it's, you know, again, you've had – clearly, you've had a bunch of dogs. You've been doing this for 30 years. You've seen dogs develop. And talking about a puppy, you know, what's your, and I think I can gather your approach just based on what you're telling me, but you're letting this dog go out and run and find birds and explore and experience things. And you shot a bird that she flushed. And I'm quite certain you're not hitting the panic button or you're on high alert or anything like that. Talk me through your approach to letting a young dog get out and start to learn how to hunt wild birds.
Well, it took me a while to learn this, but what I do right from the start, I take them out to the kennel. I mean, they're just 7, 8 weeks old. You know, they're following me around. And once they bonded to me, I can go anywhere. And I got this little fur missile, you know, wandering around in front of me or by me. I take them out to the kennel and they hear the barking and they visit with the other dogs and I put them in there. And then when I run the dogs, when they get a little older, and they can actually run along with me. You know, when I turn out, you know, I'll have maybe two or three dogs out in the kennel if they're not in the house. And I'll turn them out, and I've got a mile course around my pasture, and I'll run the dogs. Well, they learn to run with them.
Yeah.
And they learn from the other dogs for probably the first 8 months of their life. You know, they'll see them point. They'll see them retrieve, especially the running part. Especially when I'm walking and the dogs are in front, they're looking, they're watching the other dogs,
right?
But they're watching how those other dogs, the other dogs never run off and leave me. And, you know, my dogs are always looking for me, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And so, sometime in there, I'll take her out into the pasture and she'll be out in front. They also learn to stay in front that way. She'll be out in front and I'll just hide behind a tree and she'll turn around and she'll miss me and it'll scare her. And, you know, she goes, oh my gosh. And different dogs react differently to that.
Right.
And then what I'll do is I'll kind of peek at her. And when she's turned away, looking away from me, I'll pop back out and I'll give her a call and she'll just go, oh my God, there you are. Oh, thank you, Jesus. There he is, you know? all my dogs learn that way that if they're not careful, they can get lost.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody might say, I was worried when I first started that they might say, well, they'll just never get very far from you. Oh, no. What they will do is though, they'll know where I am and they may be 200 yards away, 300 yards away, but I'll watch them and they'll get up on top of the hill and they'll find me and then they'll go back to work. And, you know, it's just one of those little tricks that I use, but, so I do that until, and they're not wearing any kind of collar at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, electrical, no training collar at all. I may, when they get big enough, like Jade here, I'll put a training collar on her with an, you know, I use a Garmin Alpha.
Yeah.
And when we were out hunting, she wore one because I had to have her location at all times. You know, she might chase a deer or,
yep,
you know, chase a squirrel or get lost or whatever.
Doing puppy and stuff. That
way, yeah, doing puppy stuff. And so, you know, there's no transmitting, no nothing like that on it until they're at least a year old. And then that's when I go ahead and introduce them to the collar. And I actually went to a school that Garmin put on.
Oh.
It was Tritronics back then, but went to a Tritronics school to learn how to use that collar. And it's a lot different than most people think.
Yeah.
So I went to that school. I was concerned about it. And I would probably say that most people could benefit from doing that or watching a video or something, probably a YouTube video.
Yeah,
out of it now. But
I think I maybe have an idea. But what's the main kind of takeaway that you took? You know, as far as like
the main takeaway on using the collar that I learned is the introduction, where you start out on a one or a two, just enough to where you see them either blink an eye, mm-hmm, or flick an ear or something, but not move their head, not yell, nothing like that.
Yeah,
just to where you know that they feel something small. Okay. And that's what you start out on. And from then, and I'm not going to go through how to do it, but you're basically teaching them to turn off the stimulation.
Got it. Yep.
By doing what you want them to do. And I teach them three things right off the bat. I teach them to come. I teach them to go away. In other words, to get in their box, mm-hmm, and I teach them to stop, to whoa.
Yep.
So with the same stimulation, I teach these pups at a year old to come, to whoa, and to load up,
yep,
or to go in, to get in the kennel. So I teach them three things right off the bat. And I don't teach them one thing at a time. I'll teach them all three at once because I don't want them to associate that stimulation with doing one thing.
Hmm.
Most people use a dog to, that's the collar, they teach them to come to them.
Right.
And so when a dog feels a collar, even if it's on a one, or a two or anything, they go, oh, I better get over there right away.
Right.
I want my dogs to learn that so you stimulate them first, then you give the command, and then you show them what to do. For example, to come, use a check cord. So I'll stimulate them here and then pull them to me. And then as soon as they start coming to me, I let off the stimulation.
Goes off. So yep. Gotcha.
Dogs are smart. They are really, they're brilliant actually. Right. And they know how to turn things off and on, and they, you know, that's how we train them. So that is diametrically opposed to what most people think you should do with a collar.
Yeah.
They use it as a correction tool. And I that's not really the way that I use it. Eventually I cannot remember the last time I actually used anything but the tone on any of my dogs.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
But I've got it. If a dog's running or going after a javelina or, you know, chasing after a coyote, he's going to feel it.
Yeah.
Because he's, I'm going to give him a chance to turn, you know, I'm going to give him a chance to obey.
Right.
But I want him to kill himself. So it's always there, but no, I don't hardly ever. And I, like I said, I cannot remember the last time I had to actually stimulate a dog. So.
Yeah. I think whether that's in the genetics, buying smart dogs that are biddable and cooperative or not, but they, as you point out, they're very smart. It doesn't take much coaching and developing and showing them a few things. And you get to a place where you're essentially on autopilot when you're hunting, and they require very little communication, correction, et cetera. But like you said, you've got it there in case you need to use it.
Absolutely. And, you know, doing field trials helps too, because they have to be a little bit more trained, a lot more actually. And, you know, they're trained to a standard. And you have to train them to that standard, or you're just not going to score well. You're just not going to do well in the trial.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that really helps. That really helps focus what you're doing. And I write a in the Nastra magazine. I write a little article every once in a while, and I put in there that I like to train my dogs for the Nastra standards, and then they fall right into the hunting standards. You know, and I enforce master standards when I'm hunting. I don't let a dog drop a quail in front of me. I don't care how dry he is, or, you know, I don't care if that pheasant's spurring him. You know, I want that bird brought to me and put in my hand.
Gotcha.
And if they drop, I make them pick it up and hand it to me. And I learned a long time ago, if you get slack in the field, the first trial you run, that dog's going to spit that bird out.
Sure. Yeah.
right before he gets to you, which is, a no-no. So
yeah, well, that's a lot on. I did want to get into the dogs a bit with you, and it sounds like, so you, the one question I had left, which we can sort of see how it played out, but that first dog, you know, we know the story there, and you pretty quickly decided that you were into the dogs and you were going to start running trials, and there was just no turning back on all accounts.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So I found out later when I started doing trials with Rocket that I was going to have to up my game dog-wise.
Yeah.
I expected to show up in these field trials because, you know, these guys, NASA was kind of in its, I got into NASA in 91. They'd been around quite a while before that, but it was small. My NASA number is 83, 81. And they're up to like in the 20,000s now, for member numbers. You know, that doesn't mean they have 20,000 participants.
Sure.
But, so, and I've been doing it now for 30 some odd years, but, you know, there's guys, a lot of people I know have been doing it longer than me, because kind of stick around and do it. But these guys were professionals. There's a lot of guys out there doing it that's what they do. That's all they do.
Yeah.
Is these field trials with their dogs. And, you know, if a casual trialer like I was shows up, they're just going to rub their hands in glee because, you know, they're going to take me apart.
Yeah.
You know, and that happened many times. I have no idea why I kept me coming back. I'll tell you the truth. I got whacked so many times, but now Nastra's amateur division where new guys can compete against new guys and prevent that from happening. So it's very, very new guy friendly, and that doesn't happen. So, but you still have to have the dog, and you still have to have that genetic dog that comes out there that can master the requirements.
Yeah.
Point, back, retrieve, obedience, and ground cover. And those are what you're scored on: point, back, retrieve, obedience, and ground cover, and a back.
Yeah,
one back. You get one. So, and all that stuff. So, you know, a dog that won't, you know, that probably it won't cut the mustard in Nastra. You got a dog's got a back. In fact, you cannot win a major trial unless you demonstrate at least once that your dog will back. So it is a requirement.
Yeah.
You can win a local trial that way, but not a major trial.
I've talked a little to some folks about Nastra, but not a whole lot. But is there anything? Is the hunter involved at all, or is it strictly graded on the dogs? Or I can't remember if you're graded on your shooting and dropping birds and that kind of thing.
You're not graded directly.
Okay.
If you miss the bird, the dog will not get a score for the retrieve.
Okay.
Because unless he chases the bird down and picks it up and brings it back.
Right.
Which, funny story, I actually entered a trial with my Ruby dog, that setter I was telling you about yep. earlier. And she actually, I missed five birds and she brought five birds back and we won the trial. So that's how good she was. And now you know why I was using the sawed-off 12 gauge when I first started shooting. I shoot left-handed, and you know most guns I know are made for right-handed shooters.
Yeah.
Some of them come with cast off already on them. And so I didn't know anything about bent stocks. I didn't know anything about drop. I didn't know anything about anything. And I'm shooting these guns I pick up from somebody. Says, here, try this gun. Maybe you'd be better, you know. And you're a right-handed shooter. So I shoot, like I said, I'll shoot left-handed. And I was well into this before I realized that, hey, Randy, it's you. It's not the gun. So.
Did Ruby ever catch a wild bird?
I'm trying to think. No, she never did. Lockett caught a pheasant by the tail one time.
Okay.
Pulled out tail feathers. But Ruby never did. Ruby was polite enough to point them and not catch them. Rocket would never had any compunctions about going after a pheasant in the grass. So he was kind of a flushing dog on pheasant. But once again, I was into if it flies, it dies mode.
Yeah, he so just wanted to see him fly.
I wanted to see him fly, and so did he.
Yeah. Yep.
He was many dogs ago, though. I have a soft spot for him, though.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, you know what kind of handler he had at that time.
Absolutely do. And now, as an example, when I was doing Nastra with him, he never did get his championship, never. And I hunted, I probably did Nastra 10 years with him. And now I've got dogs that get their championship within a year, you know, just doing, you know, local trials and stuff like that. So it's a lot of it's me, but you asked about the handler does not get scored in Nastra. No, your shooting gets scored just by the fact that you've got to kill a bird for the dog to retrieve it. And that's part of the dog's, the dog is the one being judged by the judge, the dog only. And so is the handler important? Absolutely. Absolutely. The handler is important. I would say that probably these guys that are winning the national trials, the pros, I call them, they're the A team, really. Those guys, they are amazing about how they're actually thinking, what they're thinking when they're in the field competing.
Yeah.
And I have nothing but respect for them. They are incredible guys, and they are professionals in every sense of the word. So in that regard, the person that's handling the dog contributes a lot to the score. We have one guy, he's pretty famous, Nolan Huffman. I mean, he really put Brittany's on the map with his dog, Nolan's Last Bullet. I mean, I probably got the numbers wrong. And Nolan, if you hear this, you'd probably correct me. But he's like a 33-time champion or something like that. It's just amazing. And here's Rocket, couldn't even get his championship after 10 years. And this dog, Bullet's got 33 championships and,
wow.
I don't know, 10-time national champion. I mean, as a Brittany, you know, so he really put Brittany's back on the map. But Nolan was amazing. Nolan would go out and run a trial, and he could be down, you know, four birds to two. The other dog had four birds, and he has two. And he'd come off and win the trial. Hmm. He'd find three more birds somehow. And, well, part of it was the dog, but part of it was Nolan. And just an amazing guy, amazing handler. So the team of the handler and the dog are critical. So you know, guys like me that go out there, I could go out there with an A plus dog, but when I'm new, I'll make some dumb mistake, you know, like stay in a corner of the field when the other guy's out finding all the birds in the other ends of the field, you know, and I'm standing over there trying to find one bird or something, you know, the situation always dictates what you do.
Yeah.
And amateur handlers are usually their own worst enemy. We've got a program now that amateurs can go out with a guy with him and actually help them and talk to them and say, this is what I would do here.
That's cool.
And and it's pretty cool because generally they'll pick somebody that's really well known to be an excellent handler. You know, one of these pros I'm talking about, say, hey, would you mind coming out with me and being my mentor on this, on this brace.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a great, great program. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And that was the other thing. So when you are running the event, I'll have to do some more, maybe I'll have to do a NASTRA episode entirely, but there, you, when you're running, you and another handler and dog team are in the same field, kind of competing against each other. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. The format, I probably should have gone through that. The format is that you and your dog and me and my dog, we go into a blind and they go out and they hide five birds out in the field.
Okay.
Big field, 40 acres, yep. 30 acres, 20 acres, like that. And then we're called out and we go to a start line. You have your judge. I have my own judge. And we turn our dogs loose. At this point, the dogs are leashed. We turn our dogs loose and we have 30 minutes to go out and find those birds. And we're scored on how well the dog points the bird, how well the dog retrieves the bird, how well the dog's obedience, the dog's ground coverage. And if there's a back involved, they get scored for one back. And there's different amounts of points. You know, it's like 100 points for each point or find. There's 100 points for each retrieve. And there's a grading scale in there, and the judges are all certified, and they learn how to apply the scoring system. Yep. And they're writing down on a scorecard as they're going along. We used to ride horses, now we ride four wheelers, and we follow the dog. We really don't care much about the handler.
And
if a handler goes out and wants to start this and is not a very good shot, he can have a gunner.
Gotcha.
It's a good shot.
Okay.
Yeah. So we kind of tried to cover all the bases to get people involved, and it really works. I mean, it's growing in leaps and bounds now that we've got the amateur system, you know, where guys used to go out and just take a thrashing the first couple of years. Yeah,
right.
Like I did. I remember I'm going, why am I doing this? You know, I'm getting creamed, you know? And, so now that's not the case. Now you're actually competing against other new guys that are not. You know, and I think you're no longer an amateur after you've got 7 points. And you get, the way you get points is by third place you get 1 point, second place you get 2 points, and first place you get 3 points. And at 18 points, you get a championship, but 9 of those 18 points, half the points have to be first place points. So you have to have, have at least 3 first places, you know. Plus 18 points to get your championship.
The quote unquote champ. Yeah, I was wondering about that when you said that. So it's something you earn it in. There's a system for earning it. Okay, I follow you.
Sure. And there's the whole country is divided up into regions.
Yep.
How many there are? 28.
I actually just looked that up because I was curious if it was done by state. And I just looked up. I see the Mid North region, which is Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. Their website, so a little plug for them.
Yeah, and I don't know where they run most of their. I think they run most of their trials over in North Dakota.
It seems
I'm not sure.
Like it, yeah,
yeah. I mean, if you go online to nstra.org, nastra.org, and you can just click on the regions to see where they are, and they've got their schedules in there and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of them, like up north, they'll do trials all summer long. Down here in the south,
it's too hot.
Our trial season is from September through March. We have our region championship in March.
Okay.
First part of March. And it varies year to year. But the heat down here is what pretty much dictates what we do.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, cool. Up there, now you guys are under a bunch of snow. So.
Yep. Yep. We are covered up pretty good. That's for sure.
Yeah. So,
gearing up for your next hunt? Check out Ugly Dog Hunting Company for all your dog supply needs. Ugly Dog Hunting carries a full line of products for your bird dog and even some for you. Whether you're looking for dog collars, GPS tracking devices, kennels, beds, leads, training equipment, or first aid supplies, Ugly Dog Hunting carries it and a whole lot more. New owner of the company and Fred of the Birdshot podcast, Mike Nadusky, loves to remind me that while I do hunt with pretty dogs, every dog can be an ugly dog. Check out the entire selection of gear for you and your bird dog at uglydoghunting.com. For many upland hunters, along with their passion for dogs, birds, and the places we chase them, comes a passion for shotguns. Upland Gun Company specializes in customizing shotguns for the upland bird hunter, imported from Italy and shipped direct to an FFL near you. Select from one of their side-by-side or over-under shotgun platforms and customize the fit, function, and aesthetics to your liking. Design and build your next upland hunting shotgun with Upland Gun Company today. Visit uplandguncompany.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
But, can I interject something here? I want to tell you how much I love my gun. This all got started because I wrote Nick an email and said, my gun is a death ray.
that was a quote. I saw that subject line come over and I dropped everything to read that email.
My gun is a death ray and I'm not going to allow you to interrupt me while I tell them how good my gun is. By the way, I'm not getting anything from Nick to say this. I'm not sponsored by by Upland Gun Company or anything like that. So, but I finally decided I wanted a gun made for me. Before I start this, is there anything you want to cover?
You dive into this and it's a good, I was going to transition at that point. So I'll circle up at the end, but yeah, you tell everybody the gun you wound up with and your first impressions.
I had never had a gun made for me. And like I said, I'm a lefty and I've always had all semi-autos that blow the shell in front of my face. I've always, and so I really got into double guns. I love double guns. I love side-by-side double guns. I ended up with my most favorite gun up to this point has been a 1912 Ainsley H. Fox 20 gauge.
Ooh, 20 gauge.
A 20 gauge, and I had to have it restocked.
Okay. Yep.
Because it was so small for me, and people said, "Oh, that destroys the value." I said, "Well, I don't have any guns that are collectors." I mean, that one surely could have been.
Good for you, though.
And so I use them, and I shoot that gun like a dream as well, but. I just felt bad taking it out in bad weather and stuff. So I kind of was, I have other guns I use and then I got another double that it was a 20 gauge. I just latched onto the 20 gauge.
Yeah.
And another gun that I use, a double that I bought from a guy for $300 that he bought the whole collection from another guy. And it's an SKB model 100. With ejectors. And it's just, I love that gun. It fits me perfectly and it was just wonderful. And, I can lay it down on the ground and I field trial with it actually.
Yeah.
I lay it down on the ground. If it's raining, I don't worry about it, that kind of thing. So over the years, and I bought an Ansley H. Fox 16 gauge made 1933 and used that. And that just never, a beautiful, beautiful gun and paid a lot of money. I had no parental supervision at the time, so I just spent a lot of money on it.
I love it.
And so, I had this gun, and so I really wanted a bespoke gun, a gun made for me, and I'd never had it done. And I can't remember how I got onto Upland Gun Company.
Yeah.
I must have seen an ad. I think I did see an ad, and I can't remember where it was. It might have been in a magazine. I don't know.
Yep.
I'm sure it was online because I don't read a lot of magazines, but anyway, so I just kind of clicked on it and I'm reading it. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. And then I got down there and it said, what do you expect to pay and all that kind of stuff. And I'm going, so I said, right, I got this 16 gauge Fox it's a beautiful gun. So I told my wife, I said, listen, I want to buy this gun and I'm going to sell this Fox to do it. And she says, is it going to cover it? And I said, well, we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm supposed to have this gun, it'll cover it. And it did almost to the penny. It was amazing. And I did not order the gun until I sold the Fox. And a guy down South Georgia bought it and I ordered the gun. And And I got talking to you, and you asked me, what do you, I know, I filled out the form about what I wanted. And I mean, it was like the next day, might have been that day, you called me on the phone. And you said, so Randy, I see you got a gun order here. And I said, yeah. He said, well, so why did you pick 26-inch barrel? And I said, well, you know, I'm going to be using it, you know, in the grouse woods, you know, by this time, I'm a real thinker about my gear.
Yes.
So I decided I want to, you know, I'm going to want a short barrel maneuver in the grouse woods. And he said, well, you know, this gun is light, really light. And you're cutting down weight by shortening the barrel so you can swing faster. He said, you know, I really think you're going to want a longer barrel than that. Well, right about that time, I talked to two of my friends, one of them out in Wyoming, one of them in Tucson. And I told them I'm going to buy this gun. And both of them shot, one of them shoots skeet for the Air Force.
Okay.
Or sporting clays, stuff like that, you know. And he said, Randy, he said, you ought to rethink that barrel length. And then the other guy that's out in Wyoming, he's a bird hunter like me, and he's got a 28 double. And he said, Randy, you need 29 or 30 inches on that barrel. I said, 30 inches? I never had a 30-inch barrel in my life. That's a goose gun, for trying to find out loud, you know? And he said, Randy, trust me. He said, and I said, so I think the compromise on a 29-inch barrel.
Yep.
And you mentioned that. He said, Randy, I think you want something longer. So, you know, you talked me out of the 26, gave me a 29-inch barrel. And now I think I went to 28 initially and then to a 29-inch barrel. And there's some other things I knew I wanted on it. Now I'm picking and choosing every single thing. I think I went with a case hardened finish instead of the extra schooling. Kind of went back to my utilitarian background. And so I went with an extractor. Now I used to be like an ejector pig. That's what I call them. It's blast shells everywhere you go, you know. You see. And I'm sorry if I've offended somebody, but I am. I really got berated one time by a friend of mine for leaving my shells. And he said, first of all, it's sloppy. Secondly, it tells everybody where you're finding birds. And I said, ooh, I started to pay attention.
Right. Once you hear that.
You know, yeah, once you hear that. Well, I did go with extractors, and now I love extractors because, you know, I pull them out and throw shells in my bird bag, and I keep going. So I went with that. I went with a flat rib. You changed some of these. You changed it to a concave rib, I think, for me.
I might have, yeah.
And I like that. I went with interchangeable chokes, and that's not one of the things I would have changed. Because I go to so many different places that hunt so many different birds,
right?
That's important. I did want a Prince of Wales stock, though. That was mandatory. That was mandatory. I found that I do not like and do not like to shoot straight stocks. So I went with a plastic buttstock, and we changed that to a wood buttstock, which I'm so glad we did that.
Good.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I went with splinter forend, and I stayed with that. I didn't want the beaver forend, and all these things are options that are offered. Mm-hmm. And I think I went with a 2.5 grade and up that to a number 3 grade wood, and which is great. That's a beautiful, beautiful piece of wood. I remember you guys sent me pictures of, hey, here's 3 or 4 different, what do you call them?
Stock selection. The lineup we sent you.
Yeah, there's a name for them. But anyway, pieces of wood there. And I picked the one I wanted. And then they came back and they said, well, now because of your length of pull, that's not enough wood. We're going to have to try these 3.
Right.
And so I finally ended up.
Yeah.
A picking one. They were just beautiful pieces of wood, and I'm thrilled with that. Brass bead. And then I went with the left-handed shooter configuration, which is a little bit of a add-on there too. So, and I went with a single trigger. And I tell you something, that I wish I had gone with a double trigger.
Okay.
That's the only thing. 100% me. It has nothing to do with Upland Gun Company.
Yeah.
But I just like. All my other guns are double triggers. I don't know what was in my head, but I went with a single trigger, and it doesn't affect me at all, other than the fact that the double trigger does not slow me down one iota in the woods. And I just would have wanted to have that little bit of extra you know, leeway. And because I can change triggers, you know, in midstream.
Yep.
You know, I can pull on, I can be pulling that open trigger and say, whoa, and change to the other trigger if I have to. And I've done it in my other guns. And I've seen other guys do it when I hunt with them. And, you know,
yeah, I forgot that you did go single trigger there. I don't specifically recall any conversation we had around that, but yeah.
Yeah. Probably most people are afraid of double trigger.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm here to tell you, your brain handles that.
Yeah.
You don't even think about it.
Yep.
You don't even think about it. I can shoot that gun as fast. Those shells will go through there as fast as a semi-auto with double triggers, and single trigger makes no difference whatsoever.
Yeah.
As far as being fumbled up, your brain can handle it. But so I got out there the first couple hunts. We weren't into birds. I was in Montana and it was so hot.
Okay.
I shot some sharptail and some huns, but it was just so, so hot. That was 95 degrees during the day. And, you know, because I always insist on going the 1st of September like a knucklehead. And,
well, you got nothing else to do, Randy, right?
Well, I do, and then I'm so antsy also.
Yeah.
So this year I'm going to go a little bit later. So we didn't get a whole lot of birds. And then I went to Wyoming, and in Wyoming I'm hunting blue grouse, where you have pretty much a lot of time to take your time. You don't have to rush your shots. And got some blue grouse, and we hunted chucker. I never had a shot at chucker, but I did have a shot at sage grouse and Hungarian partridge and bagged some of them. But there weren't just a massive amount of birds, you know. So, and then I went to, in October, I went to Wisconsin and Michigan, and I'm hunting rough grouse. And as you know, rough grouse is just a wonderful stroll through the woods with 30 seconds of panic.
Yep.
Thrown in there while the bird, you know, it's just amazing. So, you know, I did bag a few birds with a gun then. And then in November, I went up and hunted prairie chickens. And I had some dog issues at that point. I was hunting my middle dog, and he just kind of lost his mind one day. We got into chickens, and they were everywhere. So I really didn't give the gun a fair shake. But when I got into hunting those quail in Arizona, now these quail fly roughly 5 times as fast as a bobwhite. I don't know where they go. They are rocket ships.
Yeah.
And so it was pure instinct shooting. It was. And I had, I think over the space of a couple of weeks, I probably had 5 or 6 doubles on the covey rise.
Yeah.
And I pulled off a double several times. I mean, I shot one bird down and deliberately did not shoot another bird.
Yeah.
Several times.
Yeah.
And it was pure gun fit and instinct shooting. And because the birds are so fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, shooting a covey rise of Mearns quail, or not really Mearns quail so much as blue quail and gambel's quail. Those birds by January, they're hardened campaigners.
Yeah.
They are fit. They're survivors. They're big. And they are, you're shooting them going away, and they do not give you much slack.
How do they compare to, I have a feeling which way you're going to go on this, but how do they compare to a September covey of huns getting up in front of you? Cause that's about what I could compare it to.
I would say they, you know, as far as I've shot September coveys of huns before, and I would really say that, they are much more difficult. I can't say how much. I would say,
gotcha.
You know, they're not twice as fast, but
they're not slower.
They're not slower. They are definitely not.
Yeah.
And they will run. This year I had so much fun in that last video because filming covey rises, because it's very, usually they're running ahead of the bird dog 50 mm-hmm. yards ahead of them.
Yep.
And it's just a matter of, it's a track race out there. And I hate that. but this year, because of the grass, they held like Bob White's. It was amazing. And so I'm filling these covey rise, blue quail and gambel's quail that, back in the day, you got covey rises on the early season birds because they were stupid, not because there was, they just ran just because they just were young birds. They didn't know enough
right.
to run.
Right.
And then later in the season, you never got a covey rise on them because they wouldn't give it to you, or you'd be driving along a road and they'd covey rise off the road as you out of a bush, you know. And that's the way a lot of the locals hunt them in New Mexico. They drive down the roads and watch them flush off the road, and then they jump out of the truck and run after them. So, you know, but this year they would actually hold for dogs, singles, coveys. It was wonderful. It was really nice. So when you get there and you walk up to a covey of blue quail that have a dog pointed on one side and you walking up on the other side,
yeah.
and they're already nervous. And like I said, these late season birds, they are tough. They are tough. If you want to shoot, you know, 8 shot, 7.5, you're going to have a lot of runners on your hand. You're going to knock them down, but they're going to appear. So if you shoot 6 shot, you're cutting down on your size, your number of shot, but you're more likely to have a direct kill on the bird. You won't lose as many. But when you knock down a double over a point of a covey, your dog's got to get on them right away, or you may lose one of that, yeah. one of those birds.
Yeah.
That's very common. In fact, I was driving with a rancher out there this year. We're hunting private land, and we're getting into a lot of birds because A, it was private, and B, it was his land, and he knew where the birds were. So, and he looked at me just casually as can be, because I'm driving my truck, he's riding with me. He said, "You know, Randy, when they're out here like this, you know, probably ought not to shoot more than 2 or 3 on the covey rise, you know." I started laughing. And he said, "What's so funny?" I said, "You know," I said, "CJ, you don't really understand. Your shooting is so good that you're worried about how many you're shooting on the covey rise. Most people are sitting there just can't even shoot one on a covey rise.
Tickled to drop one, yeah.
Hey, you gotta be careful not to shoot more than 2 or 3. But he says, yeah, because, you know, you'll start losing them because they just run like the wind. If you yeah. break a wing, you know, they'll run down a hole in a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
Gopher hole or something, you know. But anyway, I kind of drifted away. But I did. I got done with shooting those birds, and I texted you that email, or I sent you that yeah. email. And I love my gun. I love my gun. Now, I got that oiled stock. I love my oiled stock. I love everything about the gun. You know, it's a little stiff when you first get it.
Yep.
And I'm sitting there, I'm breaking it open, and I'm pulling those shells out, and I'm trying to get more shells in the gun, and I'm laughing the whole time because this is I just love that life. Birds are flushing at my feet, and I'm trying to get more shells in the gun.
Yeah.
I said, but that's not the gun's fault. That's the operator's fault.
Yeah.
And that happened more than once. And I think it's in the video. I'm sitting there laughing when birds are getting up at my feet. Birds, quail are coming to the right and the left, and I just missed with 2 shells, and I'm sitting there trying to get more shells in the gun. But I love it, and it fits. It's the only fitted gun I've ever had, and I can't recommend it enough. I tell guys, you know, I think I probably sold 5 guns for you. Guys that I know. There's out there, Kenny out there. I think he bought one for himself and one for his kid. And
I think I recall that name. Okay, I got you.
I can't remember his last name right now, but anyway, he's out there. And,
yes. Yep.
Yeah, he was all excited, and so
he was a pilot too. Anyway. Is that how you know him?
Yeah, he was a retired Air Force pilot.
Okay, yep. I got you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't quite good enough to be a Navy pilot, but he was an Air Force pilot, and I'm glad if he ever hears that.
I don't know if he listens, but that's funny.
Yeah. I was my buddy out there is an airport retired Air Force. And,
yeah,
we flew the same mission, not the same airplanes. We're both attack pilots, and so we're always ragging on each other, having a good time.
Love it. Well, I'm certainly biased, but obviously I could be happier to hear your thoughts and impressions on the gun. I'm so glad I got. So here's a random question. You sent me a couple lovely photos of you and the dogs in the field and the gun. And in one of the photos, you're wearing a blue plaid shirt. Is that an LL Bean shirt? You know what I'm talking about?
Well, you're not going to believe this.
You're wearing it right now.
I got that shirt on right now. And I just pulled it off and looked at it, and yes, it is.
Hello, LL Bean. Scotch plaid flannel shirt.
Yep, and It is absolutely one of my favorites, believe it or not, one of my favorites. And she gave me another one too. That's also in a video that I'm wearing, but she gave me two of them, and I think I'm wearing one or the other throughout most of them on this hunt because they're just so nice.
Yeah, you know? So, that's so funny. I asked because, so when you sent me that, I didn't think much of it other than, I mean, I like plaid shirts, so I thought, oh, that's a nice shirt. But I went and I bought a new shirt. I went to L.L. Bean and bought some stuff. I bought a new pair of jeans and a shirt, and I picked that shirt out thinking, oh, I like the looks of that shirt. I'm going to buy it for myself, and I bought it. And then something made me go back to your email, whether we were talking or not, and then I looked, and then I connected the dots, and I ended up with the same shirt. I just got it last week. I wore it to dinner last weekend, and my wife said it looked great. So I guess our wives share a similar taste, Randy.
Absolutely.
That's so funny.
I learned a long time ago. Well, there's a really major sportswear company out there that sells, has big into bird hunting and everything like that. And I'm allowed to shop on that website without parental supervision, but otherwise, no, I'm not. So, and you know, my wife actually got into my closet here in my den, right? I have all my hunting clothes. And she made a mistake. I made a big mistake. And first of all, I didn't lock the door. She went in there and started counting my hunting coats. And, you know, and so I've got to stop that. So I get on that site and I said, oh, man, I got to have that. That, hunting pants and everything else. You know, I'm a gear junkie when it comes to bird hunting. I confess. But that's amazing. You bought the same shirt.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Super funny. Yeah. It's a shameless plug for the L.L. Bean Scotch plaid flannel. It's a damn nice shirt.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It'll be for years, too.
All right. Couple things on the gun. So long barrels. You obviously went with the barrels. You've shot them now. You're happy. Talk me through that.
Yeah. Right? Oh, yeah. I could even go on with a 30-inch, actually.
Right. Right.
And it probably, because I'm 6'3", and
you got a long leg to pull, 15 1/4 inch. I just pulled up your build sheet, actually.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And you know, I was always adding those rubber bumpers,
mm-hmm.
Back of the guns, and slip on things. The guys go, and they've got a really kind of a nasty name for them, but I had to have it for the extra length on these guns, and so. That thing just absolutely fits like a dream. And, you know, the cast, I didn't really understand cast on, cast off, mm-hmm. You know, wax on, wax off, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, cast on is for left-handed shooters, you know, it bends the stock so that it gets the gun more in line with your eye. And, you know, cast off is for right-handed shooters. And I don't know why it's that way. I didn't look into the history of the term, but I wanted cast on, and well, how much? Well, I don't know, you know. So, I went to a gun I really like, and I measured everything on that, and it was no cast at all. And so then I started reading articles about what to get. I went with 1/4 inch cast on it, cast on, and the guy said, whatever you do, if you're going to put cast on a gun, don't put any less than 1/4 on. And so, you know, I might have gotten a little bit more, but the cast was important, and the cast is what I really think was kind of the key to my better shooting.
Yeah.
And because like I said, those coveys, I'm doing the instinct shooting so much. And that's when I really started to go, oh my God, I just got a double.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, that's the testament to the gun. And again, that purely instinctive shooting, throwing it up, and just all you have time to do is look at the bird and pull the trigger. So if you're dropping those birds, I mean, that's that gun fits.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I don't remember looking down the barrel.
Yeah,
I don't remember anything. I remember the gun being up on my shoulder, my cheek on the stock. You know, because I practiced that.
Yeah.
I practiced, and all I remember is staring at the head of the bird. Boom, one down. There's another one. Boom. Another one down. I went, holy cow, did I just do that? It used to be a rare thing, but when you can routinely do a double on a cubby rise, you're doing it right. You know, either that or you're shooting them on the ground.
Right. Yeah. One or the other. Yeah.
Which I do not do. I do not condone. So anyway, it's an unashamed plug for your gun. And I just think that I read about the history of the RFM.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
people in Italy. And I remember asking you, this is back in the heart of COVID when I ordered this, and I asked you, how long is it going to take? And you said, well, you know, and I said, but it was right at 6 months. So
worth the wait, Randy?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely worth the wait. And, you know, when I get another one, and I say when, not if, and I hope my wife doesn't hear that, I will, you know, I'll just be ready for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, although I don't know what I'd want, I just know that if I want one, it's going to be from you guys.
But,
yeah. Upland Gun Company, but the, you know, this thing just is, for what I do, I can do everything I do with this one gun. Totally happy. 28 gauge.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk to me about the 28 gauge, knowing that you've been around the block, you've hunted a lot of different birds in a lot of different places, you got a 28 gauge side by side. Talk to me about what you love about that.
Well, I just, you know, I started out, didn't know what to have, and that same guy that I took my first dog to, Rocket, I took him up to Tennessee, and you know, I asked him, I said, what do you hunt with? And he said, I hunt with a 28 gauge and or a 28, a 20. I'm sorry, excuse me, 20 gauge.
Yeah.
And he said, I said, what about a 12 gauge everybody hunts with? And he said, Randy, 12 gauge on quail is murder. Serious as a heart attack. He looked me in the eyes.
Yeah.
And says, don't ever do that. And I went, oh my gosh, you know, I'm just learning, you know. I went, oh my gosh, that's murder. You know, so I didn't even know what a 16 gauge was. So it brought me down to a 20. And so I got my first gun was a first nice gun I ordered was a Browning Satori 20 gauge over and under.
Yep.
And I shot the Dickens out of that. I loved it. And so that was, I just stayed with 20, and then I went to a side by side and, you know, we went through all that, but,
yep.
So I just, you know, all my guns are 20s. So I finally decided, well, I want to try a 28 gauge. So, because I'd heard guys hunting with them. Mm-hmm. My buddy out in Wyoming hunted with it. My Target buddy hunted with it. And so I said, I went out and bought a really cheap one. Only cost me a couple $100, maybe $500-$600. I bought a cheap one. And it was a straight stock 28 side-by-side.
Yep.
And hunted all last year with it, everything. And I said, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it. And I did it. Of course, it wasn't fit for me. It wasn't anything. And I noticed that I was hitting birds with it just fine.
Yep.
And more birds were dying. More birds were dead when they hit the ground with the 28 than with my 20. That is a totally subjective statement.
Yeah.
Okay. But more birds, to my mind, were dead when they hit the ground with the 28 than a 20. And I said, well, maybe there's something to this. And I started reading about it, you know, shot string and loads, 1 ounce and 3/4 ounce shot and all that stuff. And I didn't get as deep into it as the experts in the magazines, but I realized that the 28 can do anything a 20 can do. It's much lighter. The shells are much smaller.
Yep.
So I started, you know, a handful of 20 gauge versus a handful of 28 gauge. I mean, that makes a difference. It literally makes a difference in what you're lugging around. And the gun was pounds lighter, maybe a pound lighter, I guess.
Yep.
Easily a pound lighter. Now my 20 gauge Fox, you know, that's a pretty light gun, but just the sheer mass more, you know, but not much more. But that was the only gun that I ever toted that was as light as this gun. And so I decided that that little cheap 28 side by side, really kind of made me want a 28. And that's what I sent it, you know, that's how I came to you and I with a 28 gauge and that's what we ended up with. And that little 28, that's my go-to gun.
Pretty darn capable.
It is very capable. I shot sharp tail grouse, prairie chicken, pheasant, you know, bobwhite, merns quill, shot
rough grouse and woodcock.
Yeah, woodcock. Yeah, I shot woodcock with it easily. And the good thing about this gun is now I can open up the chokes. My other guns are all fixed chokes. So
yeah, and you got this the interchangeables.
One, chokes. I can go ahead and put, you know, cylinder and cylinder in there.
Mm-hmm. If
I
want to.
I ended up with the quail, believe it or not, I ended up with improved and modified.
Okay.
And tried everything. I went out there trying to shoot these with open chokes, and no. That ain't going to work.
Really?
These birds are too far out, too fast. And so I went ahead and closed up the choke some, and that's when I started having a lot more success, improved and modified. And, you know, a lot of guns come with improved and modified.
Yeah.
That's just, you know, I guess there's a reason for it.
Yeah, it's, it's kind of the default. Yep.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, field trialing, yeah, open chokes. But I shoot open choke 20 gauge. But no, bird hunting, nah. That just, you got, there's just not enough shot in there to be doing that with those birds. They will not give you any chance.
Yeah. So, briefly, what shot sizes, shooting out of the 28 gauge, different species, what's your thought process there? And I mean, I know you can, it's a rabbit hole here, but just generally speaking, what do you like for shot size, payloads, et cetera?
Yeah, it is. But I got to tell you, I made it simple for myself, and I ended up shooting on the bigger birds, the prairie chickens, the sharp tails, and even the pheasant. I shot six shot, number sixes.
Yep.
And because you know, for the sharps and the chickens, it doesn't take too many shot mm-hmm. of those size shot to knock them down. And the pheasant, you got to get a little bit more on the bird,
right?
But it worked. It worked fine, and I proved it in South Dakota this year. But for the quail, I closed the chokes down a little, like I said. But I also went to I started out shooting sixes. But I dropped it back down to 7.5s and even 8s. And I depended on my dogs. I did break a lot of wings and not have a lot of dead birds. But I had to get the birds on the ground. And my dogs were good enough to where they could recover them. And I would say probably nearly 100% of the sharp tail and the prairie chickens and the pheasant were dead when they hit the ground. I would say high 90%, but the quail, I needed to have more shot in the air.
Yep.
And when I went down to 8 shot, I had significantly more shot in the air. And the ones that weren't dead, my dogs were good enough to pick up.
Yeah.
And that saved the day. If I was going to start losing birds, I don't think I lost maybe, I think in 2 weeks of hunting quail out there, I don't think I lost maybe 2 birds.
Yeah.
My dog, and I would stay there. I would stand there.
Right.
You know, and not chase singles until we recovered the birds. And it might be 5 minutes. It might be 10 minutes, mm-hmm. but the dogs would pick. And I'd make them come in. I'd water them. You know, they'd be want to go after, you know, I'd be calling them back in. And finally I'd hold them.
Yeah.
And I'd water them. And we'd sit there until their tongue went back in their mouth. And then I'd say, hunt dead bird, make them find it. And sometimes that bird was 20 yards away from where I thought it would be, you know.
Yeah.
But they picked up. So that's what I do. I think if, you know your dogs, and you know, I'm a big believer in that saying, you know, preserve game, use a trained dog.
Yeah.
Big believer in that. I think if I had to knock them down and I was in a position where I was going to have to kill the quail, especially those wild quail, I would go to sixes. I definitely would. Yeah. Yeah. Or 7.5, no smaller than 7.5.
That's cool. The listeners will know I love all the Michael McIntosh shotguns and shooting books. And he was a big fan of the 28, and he wrote a lot in there, and kind of sort of in line with what you're saying. He cautioned readers to, as you go down in gauge and bore size, so you go down to the 28, you want to be very careful about increasing the pellet size. And if I recall correctly, 6 shot was about as big a shot as he wanted to shoot out of that small bore. And
mm-hmm.
you go down too much, or you go too big in shot size, your pellet count drops, you got a small bore, your pattern efficiency is not the same. So 6 shot was kind of the,
yep.
And then anywhere you can go down in shot size and increase and put more shot in the air, as you were saying, that's where the 28 gauge really starts to shine.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting you would say that.
Yeah.
And one thing, though, a rough grouse, small shot's fine. That's a really tender bird.
Yep.
Really, really tender. They are very, very fragile.
Yep.
And I think even woodcock are tougher than a rough grouse. Truly.
I don't know if I've ever drawn that conclusion, but I will. I will say I don't think too much. I've shot a lot of 7.5 in the grouse woods, and this year I finally proved to myself that there's really, I mean, this year I shot only 8.5 and 8 shot all season long, and I saw, you know, no difference, at least equal or if not better performance out of that. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly what I determined. I didn't realize that grouse were so fragile until, you know, when I first started hunting them, you know, when they're back in the 90s when the 40 flush days were not uncommon.
Yeah.
You know, I realized that you could shoot 9 shot with these guys. It'd probably work, you know. But you got to wait for days when the leaves are off and to do that. So, you know, you can shoot 9 shot through a leafy tree and none of them is going to make it to the other side. So
doesn't take much to slow them down.
No, it sure doesn't.
Yeah. It sure doesn't. We're going to wrap up here briefly, but I wanted to ask you a little bit. Oh, this has been a blast. We'll have to have you back on the podcast at some point, Randy, but I wanted to talk to you about grouse hunting and we'll save most of that for another day. But I did, I'd seen this probably about a year ago, but I rewatched your grouse hunt from Wisconsin last year. And I had forgot about, but was reminded of what you referred to as the bathing incident where you tried to jump across a puddle and took a nice spill. And you obviously have a good sense of humor. So you left that in the video for us all to see.
Oh, I did. And I told my guy I was on with Josh, who was laughing so hard. First of all, he was shocked. He didn't know if I was going to come up all mad or anything.
But yep,
he came out of the water. I said, go on, take a picture.
He said, take a picture.
So I actually kind of wish he had. I would have loved to have that picture of me coming out of the water with my gun underwater.
That would have been a good one. Yeah.
But yeah, right at 22 minutes in that video, by the way, if anybody wants to look at it.
Yeah.
They got a YouTube channel, Bird Hunter's Thoughts, and then of course my blog, birdhuntersthoughts.com, and YouTube channel, I already said that, podcast, Bird Hunter's Thoughts, and Turn 'Em Loose. But anyway, I try to do video blogs, but I don't know how many people watch video blogs. I guess they do if you're, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know who watches them, but anyway.
Well, the two books, Endless October. What made you want to start? You know, were you a big journal, log, note taker? What made you want to start capturing some of this stuff and put it out there?
My wife made me want to do it. Okay. she said, Randy, you write so well and you love to tell stories, which is both true.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about the writing, telling stories I do. And I've had log books going since 1992.
Okay.
And she's bought me these leather log books now. I mean, I'm really high dollar log book now, but I've got scraps of notes on,
that's cool,
on everything. I've got them, you know, they're all just here. And you know, I've got the mind that I do not need to look back in my log book. I can remember. And Josh, that guy that I was hunting with that saw me fall in the puddle, he said, how do you remember that? When I did a podcast about it, or I wrote a story about it, about us in Wisconsin. And at the end of the hunt, I described the entire hunt. And it was a chapter in my book and how we were on the tailgate drinking an adult beverage. And some guys drove by and they joined us. And another couple joined us. And a logger came by and he joined us. Pretty soon we had a party.
Oh, that's so cool.
And right there in the Wisconsin grouse woods, and I was just laughing. I was just still shaking my head how that happened. And then the whiskey ran out and everybody disappeared.
Just like that, they were gone. They vanished in the night.
And so I ended up putting a story in my book about it. I think I entitled it Whiskey, but Josh asked me, how do you remember all that? And I said, Josh, I don't know, but I've got that memory. You know, I can't remember what I was going to do when I was headed to the kitchen, but I can remember on a bird hunt, everything, everything.
Yeah.
And so I have all these stories in my mind, and the Endless October was another friend of mine. He said, this is what you ought to do. You ought to just say that, what's your favorite month? And just I just want that month to be forever, you know? So Endless October was the first book. And, I think Endless October Season 2, which is the catchy name, I think, that I really think that's probably a better effort. But But both books are basically just me hunting. They're all true.
Yeah.
There's one story in there that's fiction, and I'm careful to label it. And it's about an old guy and his dog. So I don't know how untrue it could be, but it's something that actually didn't happen. I made it up. But I did label that. And it's a story about being attacked by a moose when I was growing up in Alaska too. But otherwise they're all about bird hunting. Yeah. And I guess I've got another one coming out. She basically told me, you know, that you really need to write this stuff down. And so I said, nobody cares about it. I mean, they're all hunters. They've done this stuff. And she said, well, you'd be surprised. So I did it. It's self-published, Kindle Direct Publishing. And, you know, a lot of it's amateurish, I think. But it's basically the stories are sound because they actually happened. And, you know, there's a couple in there. There's one I wrote that I can't even read today without bawling my eyes out.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, it's about my best bird dog, you know, when he passes away.
Yeah.
But you got to have, you know, that's part of it. You know, your dogs, my gosh, they're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, it happens. And so I keep it private now. But in that one, I wrote about it. And I even did a podcast. I read the story. And I think I did it on my YouTube channel.
Hmm.
I did. I actually read the story. And towards the end there is when you'll see there, I cut out, you know,
yeah.
Then I come back to it because I just can't read my own story.
Yeah.
But anyway, I encourage you all to take a look at that if you get a chance. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. Well, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, A Bird Hunter's Thoughts, kind of, that's the HQ. Most stuff can be found there. And the books are, podcast listeners always appreciate this, the books are on Audible. You can listen to them.
Yeah, both of them are Audible, and I'm the one that
and
I go ahead and do the
excellent.
And I do the narration, and you know I fumble around occasionally, but you can get through it.
Yeah. Well, I think I might have to. I got some Audible credits to use. I think so. I think there might be some endless October in my future, Randy.
Oh, that'd be awesome. That would be awesome.
Well, I certainly appreciate you taking some time to join us on the Birdshot Podcast. This has been an absolute blast and my pleasure, and obviously fun to hear your report about the gun, and that was a cool spark to this conversation, but I really appreciate that. I'm happy for you, and can't thank you enough, Randy. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, it's been awesome. So, anytime.
Appreciate it. Well, hang on for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. We'll catch everybody on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Onyx Hunt is the number one hunting GPS app. Join millions of other hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. Onyx Hunt shows you nationwide public and private land boundaries. They've got topographic and 3D maps. You can track your route, location, and elevation profile. You can save maps for offline use and take Onyx Hunt with you wherever you go. The most comprehensive hunting tool you'll own. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and use the promo code BSP20 to save 20% on your next Onyx Hunt subscription. Know where you stand with Onyx.
Hey everyone, this is Nick from the Gun Dog It Yourself podcast. If you enjoyed this show, then you might want to check out my show as well. We highlight and break down the ins and outs of training your own hunting dog. Whether it's a bird dog or even the occasional hound dog episode, we cover all topics related to hunting dogs. Check out Gun Dog It Yourself on any podcast streaming platform and hit the subscribe button to be sure not to miss any future episodes.